Since you didn't keep talking, we're going to go ahead and call it to order. Okay. I gave you your chance. Didn't pay attention, so whatever. Anyhow, I'm Gary Gramling, chairman of the San Diego Housing Commission. I'm hereby calling the regularly scheduled meeting for November 2015 to order at 9:05. Let the record reflect that actually we have a complete attendance of the board. Just one of them stepped out of the room for just a second, but she'll be back in time for the important stuff. A couple of routine announcements. Members of the public who wish to address the Housing Commission must complete a speaker request form. Speakers are limited to 3 minutes each. Collective testimony by those who support or oppose an item shall be limited to no more than 15 minutes total per side. Non-agenda public comments are heard at the beginning of each meeting. Those who wish to address the board about a topic that is not on the agenda must fill out a white speaker request form, and so far I don't see any. Members of the public may also request to have an item pulled from the consent agenda once that has been proposed here. To speak on a matter on the agenda, members of the public must complete a speaker request form and submit it to the recording secretary sitting over here to my left, way over to my left. Didn't want you to start handing forms to Rick here. Those who wish to speak in opposition to the item must complete a pink-colored form. Those in favor of the item must complete a gold-colored form. The gold-colored one looks something like this. Okay. That's about it. So this meeting is hereby in order. First item is commissioner comments. Commissioners, any comments? Yes, ma'am.
The audit committee met during the past month, and the audit was presented to us. Commissioner Moraga and I are on the audit committee. And the audit's been ongoing for the last several months, and it's completed, and it was accepted by the audit committee, and it's on the agenda today to have the board accept it. I wanted to just give a few comments about the progress of the audit this year. Number one, there were a few hiccups because we lost Leslie, right? We lost the CFO, the chief financial officer, midpoint, but once again, Tracy stepped up with her staff and completed it on time, actually early, again received the award from the GFOA, the government agency that gives awards to public entities. And this year I asked how many of those are really awarded. I asked that of our auditors, and they told us it's less than 5% of people that apply, agencies that apply, receive that. So it really is a very important distinction. And I'd like to have the finance team stand up, and let's just give these people a big round of applause. And Tracy, Julie, can you introduce everybody? That's great. Well, thank you very much. This is the size of what they put together. Is that just like incredible? And they write this entire thing. And one of the most remarkable things, something I have never seen before in my career, which is pretty long, is that there were no journal entries that the auditors called past, which means they find little things and then they say they're insignificant to the, or immaterial to the financial statements. They found none. This is as close to perfect as it can possibly be. I'm so thankful that everything is running great. Thank you very much for your work.
I'm going to add a little bit to that and give some extreme kudos to the members of our board who are on that audit committee, but especially to Commissioner Spoon, who at the time she came onto this board, I think our financial accounting records, they were in full compliance with the requirements of HUD and with the requirements and suggestions of NARO, but they were antiquated, and that's being polite. Okay, they were incomplete from a professional business point of view. It was just sorry. And Commissioner Spoon, after attending her first meeting and having a chance to look at the first presentation of financials, and after we picked her up off the floor because she fainted because of how bad they were, took it upon herself to make sure that we, the San Diego Housing Commission, are in the forefront of bookkeeping and financial practices of the entire public housing industry. And so when we talk about the kudos for the staff, absolutely, I'm there with you. But I want to give special kudos to Commissioner Spoon especially, and also to Commissioner Moraga for their dedicated efforts in making this come forward. So another round of applause, please. Any other commissioner comments? Well, I have one. 2 days ago, we opened Alpha Square, which is just down the street at 14th and Market. Alpha Square is 200. I've seen different comments, and I'm going to explain the comments, because on our website, we say it's 201 low-income residents. But the press published the fact that it's actually 203 units. We have two resident managers on that. So anyhow, it's a 203-unit, 201 very low-income residents are moving in there in the next week and a half to 2 weeks, depending upon when certain power difficulties, and I mean electrical power difficulties, are completed. And it's going to be wonderful. It is replacing the Hotel Metro, which actually is the Hotel Metro is actually included in another item that we have later on in the agenda. But we received a nice award, a nice memorabilia for our participation. Our participation included $6.2 million in housing revenue bonds that are not a drag on the city's bond capability, and also 135 vouchers there to help help the residents to afford the rents there. So thanks to the real estate staff for overseeing and participating in the and not only bringing that project on board, but it was reported that it was brought on board under budget, which is very nice as well. So yeah. Just thought I'd let you know, and we can pass this around or you can visit it. I think maybe it needs to be in Debbie's area, the real estate area, as opposed to outside Mr. Gentry's office. He gets all those. Well, okay, you got it. Now, any other commissioner comments? Seeing no indication of such. We'll have the report by the President and Chief Executive Officer, Mr. Gentry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And initially, I'd like to turn the mic over to Councilor Christensen, who has some news of particular importance to us.
Thank you, Mr. Gentry. It's my pleasure to announce the Housing Commission. From time to time, public entities are sued, and it's not unusual. We represent approximately 10 different public entities and represent them through litigation. So the Housing Commission is no different. The Commission was sued in a case called Vargas versus the San Diego Housing Commission, which is an employment-related case. Last Friday, the Superior Court granted our motion for summary judgment, which terminated that case with a finding that there was an allegation of age discrimination. There was a finding of no age discrimination. The court determined that there was a tsunami of evidence that the commission put forward that used, that was his words, tsunami of evidence that supported the finding of no, of absolutely no discrimination whatsoever. So we're pleased to report that. In that case, the commission will actually get a judgment against the former employee. In addition, we tried a case called Malton versus San Diego Housing Commission, where there were also allegations of age discrimination. It was a 2.5-week jury trial. I've been practicing law for 42 years, and I have never received such support from a client as we received from this client throughout that entire trial. It started from the board. We've been supported by the board throughout the closed session. As a matter of fact, the plaintiff's lawyer put 128 witness names on the trial list. It turned out far fewer were called. But Chair Gramling, Commissioner Tassin, Commissioner Davis, and Commissioner Spoon's names were on that list. I contacted each of them and said, we may need you to testify. They unanimously said, we're there for you. With respect to Commissioner Spoon, she did actually testify, and I have never seen a jury so spellbound by a testimony of a witness in my life. They were literally sitting on the edge of their seats. And we talked to the jurors after the verdict came in, and they said we needed more witnesses like Commissioner Spoon. So, but in any event, and then going right down the list, the president and CEO on three different occasions rearranged his calendar so he could be present to testify as well. He did, and he hit it out of the park as well. Jurors loved him, and I guess I shouldn't say that, but Jeff Davis was instrumental in making sure that we had the support we needed. Nicole DeBerg, our former CFO, testified, did a great job. Tracy McDermott testified. We appreciate what she did. Joel and Christy Huerto from finance and from human resources. Michael McKenna was there every day, and testified, did a great job. Tina Holmes was great support for us throughout the process. Debbie Ruane was on the witness list and didn't have to testify, but she was ready to go. Kerry Clemens and his IT team provided us with backup that was necessary to try the case. Deborah Fischel-Falk actually came down to the court. We thought she'd need to testify to rebut testimony that came in, what we thought was going to come in at the trial. It didn't, so she didn't have to testify. She really wanted to. I'm kidding. But in short, it was a total team effort. The result of the case was on two of the plaintiffs, Ms. Ho and Ms. Gidcom, the Housing Commission got a defense verdict 12-0 after 2.5 weeks. The jury came to that verdict in 2 hours. The other case, which is Malton, there wasn't a defense verdict, but there was a verdict for $20,000. That will be the subject of a closed session matter later in the day. We're going to recommend that certain post-trial motions be made. We think the jury got that wrong, and we're going to take action to see if we can't correct it. In short, we appreciate the, and I need to thank Joel Mason of our office, who acted as sort of the coordinator between the retained firm, which was Paul Plevin. Fred Plevin was in court each day, as was I. He tried this lawsuit and did an absolutely amazing job. So, again, I want to thank the commission and Mr. Gentry and the entire staff for all the support we got.
And if I could add to that, my thanks to Counsel Christensen as well as Counsel Plevin. You know, a lot of different people think they set policy for this organization. Some of them take that contention to court. This body here, as well as the city council, sitting as the housing authority, does that. And this was excellent work by Chuck and his cohorts. And I think it just sends a message on who sets policy and who carries it out here. And I couldn't be more pleased with the way these proceedings have played out. Also, Mr. Chairman, three other very brief comments. Number one, I want to express my thanks as well to Tracy McDermott for once again stepping into the breach. This is twice in a year and a half she's been acting CFO. Was excellent last year, excellent this year. couldn't be more pleased with her presence and also with her bench strength with the finance staff, as you heard from Commissioner Spoon. And also my thanks to Commissioner Spoon, who is a one-person unpaid finance consultant that has been huge for us over the last 6 years or so. But thank you both. Also, two other very brief announcements on things that have happened since the last board meeting. The first one, this seems like light years ago now, but really it was just over a month ago. HUD Secretary Julian Castro visited here on October the 19th, and he toured the Hotel Churchill, as you can see from the picture on the screen. And as you all know, the Housing Commission is one of 39 housing agencies across the country involved in a program called Move Into Work, which gives us a lot of flexibility with the federal funds that flow to us. We're using those funds heavily to pay for the rehab of the Hotel Churchill, which you can see out the window here to my right, which we expect to have done late summer. Secretary Castro, as the head of the organization, provides that funding, is essential to us. He was very pleased with what he saw and took the opportunity to also announce that HUD was taking a look at the federal formula, which is used to allocate homelessness funds, which a lot of us believe shortchanges San Diego. We hope for some change to that next year. I've also heard from friends at HUD in Washington that at a staff meeting of all staff and then a meeting with the press the week afterwards, Secretary Castro pointed out San Diego Housing Commission's good work in responsibly utilizing federal funds and in serving the homeless and homeless veterans. So we are getting attention on the national stage as well. One final announcement, Mr. Chair. As you all probably well know, on October the 29th, we issued our fiscal year annual report for the year 2014 through 2015. Just three numbers I want to point out to you. In our largest program, the voucher program, are assisting right now some 15,455 families with that program, as pointed out in the annual report. In our fiscal year 2015, we expended some $55.8 million directly into programs administered by the Housing Commission for the homeless. And we've also, in the real estate shop, have created some $675 million worth of partnership developments in fiscal year 2015 alone. These are remarkable achievements. It shows the continued good work by this agency and wonderful work by our staff. Not the least of which is this annual report, which is we produce, I'll point out, entirely in-house by Maria Velasquez and her communications staff. This is, I think, the third year we've done an electronic report. It still blows me away to see this stuff. I'd like to ask Maria and her folks to stand up and just be recognized as well, please. As you can see, it's a huge department. But there are two parts to having a good reputation. Number one is doing good work. The other one is making sure everybody knows that we do good work. And we do both of those exceedingly well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Next on the agenda is to propose the consent agenda. And just so that you know, each month, usually a few days before the meeting, I send an email to the board just telling them that I'm proposing to add the following items to the consent agenda. I also tell them in that email that I don't want a response because it's merely my suggestion. And I tell them this so that they have time to make sure they look at those items in particular to see if they agree with that or if they think that maybe we ought to hear some items. And so I'm telling you that because most of the board doesn't know it, but I'm making a couple of changes to the email that I sent out a few days ago. And so they get to listen carefully to see what those changes are. So I'm proposing that the following items be moved to the consent agenda. Item 100, 101, 102, 103, 105, 108, 109, and 113. Now, the proposal is based on the following. Some of these are rehearings of items that we've already gone through a detailed presentation on, and it's just moving the item to the next level, virtually with no changes. Sometimes it's items that the board has been sent briefing materials on during the month, and so now it may not be as important to discuss that particular item in the full detail unless they have individual questions that they wish to raise. And so, and believe me, even though this is the lengthiest list of proposed consent items I've ever submitted here, we have lots of items in addition to here. So those of you who wish to be here and listen to everything, please plan to be here for a while. You want to make the change before we vote? Okay. Council?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. With respect to number 103, there's a slight modification. Item, when the board votes on this on consent, I want it just noted for the record that item 2 is being forwarded to the Housing Authority of the City of San Diego without any recommendation by this board. So, in effect, the board is not voting on subpart 2. It's going to the Housing Authority without recommendation. The reason for that is the action could potentially benefit members of this board, and for that reason, it's more appropriate to have the Housing Authority vote on it. With respect to part 1 of this, because the amount is more than $250,000, which is the limit for this type of action by our board, I'd like to amend this motion to state that the debt matter number 1 will also be forwarded to the Housing Authority for action. However, on item 1, this board will vote for the recommendation. That concludes my comments.
Mr. Chairman, did Council say 102?
If I did, I meant 103.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You've heard my proposed consent agenda. Is there a motion? Commissioner Surdy has moved approval of the consent agenda. Is there a second? Commissioner Hubbard has seconded that motion. Any discussion?
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Was there any reason why we couldn't include 112 in the same, or does that have to require a discussion?
I think the nature of the item is such that it ought to be part of the public record with a full discussion. And that's why I did. If you wish to propose it, you're certainly welcome to.
It's a committee recommendation, and if the board has any questions, we can take them. But
so you propose amending the consent agenda to include 112?
I do.
Is there a second to that motion?
Second.
Okay. Commissioner Tasson has moved that we amend the proposed consent agenda to include item 112. And Commissioner Spoon has seconded that motion as the, how do people wish to vote on the proposed amendment? I've got to make sure I've got my Roberts down correctly.
I suggest
all in favor say?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, then item 112 is included on the proposed consent agenda. Going back through, it's item 100, 101, 102, 103, 105, 108, 109, and 112, and 113. Okay. All in favor say?
Aye.
Opposed? The consent agenda is approved. Thank you very much. Before we move on, I do want to add one other comment regarding item 103, which was the workman's comp. And I just want to call to everyone's attention the fact that the workman's comp agenda item is asking for approval of the fees for our workman's compensation program for next year. The fee amount is 26.3% less than the rate that we paid in the current year. And anytime your workman's comp fees go down, it's a reflection of the work habits and work safety habits of your staff. And all I can say is, please, department heads who are here, any other staff members who are here, please convey to the rest of your workers and your coworkers our appreciation as a board for your paying attention to work safety habits. And it's not just a savings financially here. It's a savings in terms of work productivity that benefits the entire organization and thereby benefits the community of San Diego. So thank you very much. With that, we're going to move to item 104. Parkcrest Senior Apartments Property Rehabilitation.
Good morning, Commissioners, Chair Gramling, Mr. Gentry, and Council. My name is Jennifer McKinney. I'm the Vice President of Real Estate Operations. Item 104 is a recommendation by staff to approve additional funds needed in order to move forward with the rehabilitation plan at Parkcrest Senior Apartments, located at 5330 Orange Avenue in the City Heights neighborhood. With me today is Emmanuel Arellano, Director of Portfolio Management, to share additional details regarding this project.
Thank you, Jennifer. Good morning, Commissioners, Mr. Gendry and Mr. Christensen. Again, my name is Emmanuel Arellano, Director of Asset and Portfolio Management. The requested action before you is to recommend to the Housing Authority of the City of San Diego approve the revised funds request in connection with the rehabilitation plan of the Parkland Senior Apartments. This action will approve the addition of $914,000 in Build America Bonds loan proceeds and $238,000 in local funding. This action will also allow the President and CEO to execute all documents and instruments and to implement such actions as necessary to make this project completed. In August of 2012, the Housing Commission approved the acquisition and rehabilitation of the Parkcrest Senior Apartments in the amount of $8.9 million. In October 2012, the Housing Commission acquired Parkcrest, a 71-unit senior apartment complex in the City Heights community. Soon after acquisition, a new roof was installed, and three units in need of immediate repairs were rehabilitated. Earlier this year, the Housing Authority approved a revised rehabilitation plan that increased the project funds by $862,000. On March 5th of this year, the Housing Commission entered into a contract with ABC Construction to rehabilitate the first 14 dwelling units. The rehabilitation of these 14 units was completed on September 2015. Concurrently, while construction was underway, in May of this year, the Housing Commission issued an invitation for bid seeking qualified contractors for the remaining rehabilitation work at the Parkcrest Apartments. The scope of work under the technical specifications included a comprehensive rehabilitation of 54 units, four of which are to be converted into fully accessible units. On July 16 of this year, the Housing Commission received one bid from LDCO Inc. in the amount of $2.4 million. The bid receipt was $650,000 more than budgeted by staff through the in-house cost estimate. The additional funds requested under this action will allow for additional scope items to be completed as part of the comprehensive renovation, including exterior paint, fence removal and replacement, light fixtures replacement, and modernization of the community room, as well as additional elevator repairs. A notice to proceed was issued on October 27 to begin work on the 32 units based on the original approved budget. Upon approval of this action by you and the Housing Authority, the remaining 22 units will be completed, as well as the additional repairs previously mentioned. Final construction construction completion is scheduled for spring of 2016. In front of you, there's a rendering of the exterior of the property. And here are some before and after pictures of some of the units that have been already rehabilitated. This concludes this presentation. We're available to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Good. Board members, any questions? Commissioner Chasson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Arellano, I noticed we did due diligence on this when we first acquired the property in 2012, right?
We did, yes.
We assessed what was going to be needed in order to rehabilitate this project.
Correct.
Did we not see that these improvements were going to be incorporated as part of that rehabilitation?
I think we saw some of them, but since the commission has owned the property for quite some time, not in excess of 2 years, we've identified additional repairs. And in an effort to address all of the needs, and rather than addressing some of the needs now and having to come back to the property a couple years down the road, we thought it was a better initiative to address all of the needs at once. So that's one of the reasons for the increase in budget, additional items uncovered.
Over the course of the last 2 years, 2.5 years that we've owned the property, has the exterior paint deteriorated such a point that we didn't identify it initially?
I don't think it has deteriorated to such a point. I think, again, one of the reasons was while the remaining paint might have the exterior paint might have some remaining items left in its useful life, we thought it was beneficial in as far as to reaching economies of scales and efficiencies, or project efficiencies, to address all of the needs of the properties at once, as opposed to having to do some of this, address some of the needs now and having to come back 2 or 3 years down the road and do address additional items of the property.
Wouldn't it have been appropriate to have identified this when we first started due diligence?
It probably would have. It would have been one of the items that might have included from the beginning.
Good morning, Debbie Ruane, Senior Vice President, Real Estate Department. When we acquired this was the last asset we bought with our Build America Bonds funds, and we did do a due diligence assessment of the work to be done. Since that time, the building has been used quite hard by the residents, and we have decided that we want to not disturb the seniors who live there. It's a big initiative for us to relocate people out of the building and bring them back in. And so since we have excess Build America bond funds, we wanted to increase the scope of work that we identified through the initial due diligence period and touch this building once instead of having to come back in a few years and touch it again. Additionally, construction costs have increased over the last 3 years, and so what we thought we would be spending has been exceeded.
My point, I acknowledge that prices have gone up on materials. My point was in the due diligence that we did. If we didn't see the need back then to do paint, for example, the exterior of the building, you know, now we see it. Is it primarily, from what you're telling us, due to the fact that you feel like we have the resources available? And is that one of the reasons that you're bringing that forward?
We do have the resources available. We're using the local funds are actually for the green physical needs assessment, which is resources that we would be using to maintain the property in the long term. Also, we've replaced windows, so that necessitates painting on the exterior as well. And when we did the initial due diligence, we looked at what we absolutely needed to do. Now we're looking at what we want to do as well, since we have the funds.
Before you leave, I too have got great concerns about this request today. Not because I believe that the request isn't justified, it's because I have concerns over our initial estimating. This represents a $2 million bust in our budgeting. We went from an initial construction cost estimate of approximately $1.9 million and we're now at almost $3.8 million. Okay. That to me, and our green physical needs assessment was in place more than 2 years ago, so to bring that up today as a justification for any cost bust, I don't accept. I want to know what we have done to correct the errors we made in our initial estimating, because, as I say, you know, the $2 million bus actually doubles the cost of this project. And I don't think that we're doing our job here if we're not challenging you to explain that in greater detail. Personally, unless we've got some deadline that's really critical, I'm prepared to vote no when this comes to an issue or to table it for additional information on it. So can you begin to explain to me where we have those errors in our initial estimating and what we have done to correct it?
And Mr. Chairman, if I could just piggyback on that for a second. I'm interested in knowing, had we known that the numbers would have reached the level that we had we still acquired the property back then, had we known it was getting to this point?
Worthwhile question. Mr. Gentry?
I'm going to ask Councilor Christensen to speak as to the timeliness of the expenditures, and I'm prepared to address the acquisition costs.
Yeah, so Build America bonds, which were obtained by the commission, have a period of time during which we need to deploy those or we lose the ability to utilize them. And I think that's one of the reasons this action is being brought forward here today, is to utilize those. And so to answer your question, it is somewhat time sensitive to deploy or commit them.
We heard that. That's clear. The question is that sufficient justification for us to become going forward with this at this stage? I think the point the chair and I are trying to make here is that it's not the first time that we deal with the due diligence being done up front. And we understand that those of us that have been in construction, we understand that there's times when you find things that you didn't find initially. But something, I mean, 2.5-3 years later, we all of a sudden decided that the paint's deteriorated to the point where we're going to repaint the whole outside. We didn't see that then.
If I may, the scope of work that we're approaching now is in excess of the original assessment we got from the...
Well, we understand that.
Okay. Because we have the money, the Build America bonds, which have to be used. This is our last acquisition with the Build America bonds funds, and the property will benefit greatly by the enhanced work that we want to do to it. Furthermore, if we do this now, we won't have to revisit the property for an extended period of time, allowing staff to go on to do the other assets that have been identified through the Green Physical Needs Assessment.
If we didn't have the funds available, would you be bringing this proposal forward?
No, we would be doing the work that was originally approved when we acquired it.
We've heard a couple of times now, just in this discussion, that the Build America bonds must be utilized by a certain time frame. What is that? What's the expiration date on this project for those bonds?
I would like the ability to go back and look at it. My recollection is it's 5 years from the date that it was originally committed, and we're getting very close to that period now. I'd have to go back to look exactly at it. And we had bond counsel involved. Ori Carrington was bond counsel on it. So Attorney Moore is the one that I would check with. I might also say, after the property was acquired, it was determined, and it was impossible to determine before, that there were problems with the elevator. And part of the rehab that's being done currently are elevator related. Otis Elevator was the entity that was involved, and as you know, and there were constraints in the shafts for making these elevators ADA compliant. And I think that's one of the things that's being done currently.
Commissioner Surdy?
A question. Reference was made, and I forget the adjective that was used, but that the condition of the building is currently more deteriorated because of the use. The residents in the property perhaps have been hard on the structure? There was a reference to that.
That was my comment, and it's the building has been it has not had enough attention since we bought it because we were waiting to do the rehab all at once. So in the time that we bought it to now, we have not done enough rehab on it. So that was the intent of my comment.
You know how hard those seniors are in City Heights on buildings. I'm still not comfortable with the urgency because I'm not comfortable with the rest of the answers. So I'm ignoring Mr. Gentry only so that I can finish my sentence. And then I'll recognize him. But I think we need more information, if possible, right now as to what the urgency is and how severe that urgency is. I realize this is our last meeting of this year. But if the urgency is because the bonds have to be utilized in the next 60 days, that puts one twist to the whole thing. And if they don't have to be utilized or committed to be utilized in the next 60 days, I'll reiterate my position that I'm comfortable with the potential of tabling this. So can someone find that out? Commissioner Spoon?
You know, I think what there is here is a sensitivity to the underestimates. I mean, we've heard this before, so I think that's the pushback that you're getting. Gary, the building needs to be painted. Paint it now or paint it later. But you're going to paint the building, right? I mean, at some point, those repairs need to be done. So I don't know that... I don't know that tabling it will solve your question, you know, will answer your question. Because your question really isn't, does it need to be painted? And the other issues that need to be taken care of. Your question is, why was it missed several years ago? That's really your question.
And continue to be missed for two plus years.
Yeah. My question is, I guess my response is, the work will be done. The work will be done at some point. So it's do it now or do it. Pay me now or pay me later.
The original estimate was done by GAFCON. We felt that they were an excellent company with a great reputation and had done many estimates with them before. They missed some of the things that we found after acquiring it and doing our own due diligence, in addition to the elevator work, which was quite extensive.
Is this the first project that they missed stuff on their due diligence?
I don't know. I think yes, because we were happy to have them do the estimate for us on this asset.
It may be a matter of degree. You can miss it a little bit and on the low side, and it's not critical. But when you miss it by this degree, it draws everyone's attention. This is the worst example, I know for a fact, of Gascon's work. Okay. In response to your comment, I know. It sounded like something that might come from either a wife or a parent. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're absolutely correct. The issue is why did we have the bus that we have? Why wasn't it picked up sooner? As Mr. Tassin said, would we have purchased this property had the estimating been done more accurately? And sometimes, you know it may be coming down the road anyhow, but sometimes you may postpone gratification of that desire in order to drive home a point. And so, again, my point is that, and maybe it's just making an example, I think we need assurances, and we need to know what is and has been done to keep this sort of bust from happening again. Commissioner Moraga?
Just to clarify for me, what was, quote-unquote, the missed stuff, and what was what we added on to expend these funds? Because I think that needs to be separated, because there's two different conversations going on.
Right. That's a really good question. So I think the bigger portion of the delta, the difference in the new budget, is that the original estimate was inadequate. It was lower than it probably should have been from the very beginning. On top of that, we've had seen a substantial increase in construction costs nowadays. And I think also that something that it's important that we make a note of is the fact that we only received one bid. So really, it's really difficult for us to gauge how much our estimate was off, because we only received one bid. Had we received multiple bids and we see that all two, three, or four happen to be higher, well, that's a really cool and really good indicator. Sorry, I know I deviated from the original question. We are adding the exterior paint. That's definitely an add-on. We did decide to do additional community room improvements. There's additional elevator repairs that are being done. We are replacing all the lighting fixtures throughout the property, interior and exterior. And the additional items that we're doing, I think, the fence, yeah, thank you. We are replacing the fence of the property.
And one other thing, after the property was acquired, there was an architect that was retained to actually do the design of the ADA requirements, and it expanded exponentially what was originally portrayed on the GAFCON report, and we needed to do it. And by the way, there was a change in federal law during that time, too, that impacted all this thing. So that now went through the city and got an approval. And I think some of those costs relate to that as well. I think four of these units are ADA units, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I'm not sure how many of the $2 million bus can be attributed to upgrading four units and making sure that they are fully ADA compliant. Somehow, again, the logic of proportion doesn't seem to be working here. Commissioner Tassel?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that this commission is opposed to investing into getting our housing inventory up to the level of that it should be. I think what we're talking about here is this isn't the first time that we have a due diligence issue. We had one just 3-4 months ago, it seems to me, on a project a couple blocks away from here. We'd like to know up front what we're getting into with these projects. I'm asking myself, are we gold plating projects? Are we going overboard? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but it sure is it's better to know up front what we're getting into than to piecemeal the improvements that we're going into with these projects. We know we have to improve the quality of this inventory. This commission is not against that. That's not the issue.
Okay. Mr. Gentry?
I remember when this property was purchased very well. To lead the board back to those days, for those of you who were not here, when the public housing conversion process was approved by HUD in September of 2007, the Housing Commission here committed to three things. Number one, we would change the subsidy form from Section 9 under the Federal Act to Section 8 and allow residents in the former public housing properties the ability to walk if they wanted to and move to other properties. Pretty gutsy decision. Second thing we promised to do was that for any units vacated, we would reoccupy with families at or below 80% of median income, 50% for the elderly. We have accomplished that, and we've lost about 25% of our voucher holders in the last 8 years. We've reoccupied those units with a vacancy rate consistently less than 3%. The third part, and the part that was the most exciting, was that we promised HUD that we would use the equity in the ground in these 1,366 units to create debt to achieve an expansion of at least 350 units. We issued $95 million in debt between December of 2009 and September of 2010. In the summer of 10, we looked into the Build America Bonds program that was part of the stimulus bill of 09 that helped us. And we're actually able to create an additional 810 units, not 350, but 810 units with the $95 million. My recollection, Debbie, is that we used about $90 million of those proceeds. We saved about $5 million on purpose for this exact issue. We're out there acquiring properties rather than building. And any time you acquire a property that's already been in use for some time, you're essentially getting a pig in a poke. You can estimate pretty closely to what you think your needs are, but they can change once you get into the building. This particular property was the last of those properties that we acquired in that program, the last of the 810 units. And this was in 13, as I recall. And by that time, the market, we'd managed to hit the Great Recession and bottom dead center, which was good for us on acquiring these properties. But that window was drawing to a close. My recollection is that the per unit cost of this was very good. We were getting a property with good bones. We knew it was going to need some work, and perhaps the estimate could have been better. I will not contest that contention. But we also knew that we would have to go back in and relook at these properties we acquired and do some additional work on them. So in this one, as Commissioner Spoon indicated, the work is needed. I would recommend that the board approve this expenditure so that we can commence with the work and not put the bond proceeds in jeopardy. I'd be willing to have any sort of follow-up report or meeting with this board or the real estate committee or any other venue you'd like to have to take a look at where we could have done better. I don't doubt that, but I think that my smart aleck description of this business is it's not called theoretical estate, it's called real estate for a reason. You get into real issues, and those issues are not always what you expect them to be. And I think that this, in this case, is within what I would consider a reasonable set of variances. If I'm wrong on that, then I'm wrong, but I would be glad to give you all any sort of follow-up report, hearing, explanation, go into the issues in great detail as the board wishes.
And, Mr. Chair, we'd be willing to take a look at our pre-due diligence contracts and how we assess assets before we invest in them.
Commissioner Davis?
Would it be cost-effective at all on large projects like this to have two independent estimates so that you could see if one would miss something dramatic like that? You would at least have two to compare. It wouldn't depend on just one report. Would you answer that?
We'd be willing to do that. Yes, it will increase the cost. It's very possible there will be a deviation between the two. And then what do you do? Do we go with the lower one? Or do you split the difference? So we'll have to work through that. But, clearly we need to address our due diligence up front.
Yeah, I just believe that if there were two independent, companies doing this, that one might catch something, like, for example, the major elevator repair. One might recommend that where the other might not have, and it might have helped clarify everything.
I'm going to take issue with one word that you used in your responses in the last minute, and that is that you would be willing.
We will.
Yes. Yeah. This issue highlights some things that are of significant concern. As Commissioner Tassin said, we had the same issue fairly recently, and the numbers were significant. And all we're doing is expressing our concern on behalf of the people of San Diego that these dollars be utilized properly and that we have as accurate and detailed information in advance when we're being asked to make the initial decisions as absolutely possible. Okay. So, let me separate that. You're making two motions, really. You're moving to approve this recommendation from staff as one motion. You're then motioning, as I see it, that we get an additional report as to our methods of analyzing and looking at properties for our future consideration. Am I close to being? And Commissioner Surdy has seconded that motion. Is there any additional discussion? Okay, we'll take a vote. All in favor of the proposal as indicated, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Me. Okay, as to that, two of us are opposed, Commissioner Urtasun and Commissioner Gramlin. Thank you. Item 106, single room occupancy. Okay, before we begin this presentation, Mr. Gentry has asked to preceded with a little preface, so go for it.
And it'll be short. The reason this is here before you all is because of a commitment I made to the City Council about 6 months ago. There have twice in the last year the city has granted an exception to its existing single room occupancy ordinance for two properties in downtown. Following the second one, I was asked and then committed to bring a proposed revision to the SRO ordinance back to the council by hopefully the end of this year or certainly sometime soon. So that's the background of this as we're responding to the city council request. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll turn it back to you.
Well, thank you, Wendy. Good morning, Ann Kern, Vice President of Housing Finance and Program Development. With me is Wendy DeWitt, our Director of Business and Program Development. And as Mr. Gentry has said, the Housing Commission has been working on potential revisions to the SRO ordinance. One of the many activities that we do is administration of the various affordable housing ordinances on behalf of the city. And periodically, these ordinances are in need of update and review. Wendy DeWitt's team has been working with various stakeholders to bring forward what we believe are improvements to the ordinance, and Wendy has a detailed presentation for you.
Thank you, Ann. Item 106 involves proposed revisions to the City of San Diego single resident occupancy hotel regulations. We're asking that the Housing Commission recommend that the City Council approve proposed revisions to the city's SRO hotel regulations ordinance as described in the report and direct that the city attorney work with the Housing Commission President and Chief Executive Officer, and Housing Commission General Counsel to draft ordinance revisions that reflect the Housing Commission proposals and then return to the City Council for introduction and adoption of the revised ordinance. There are no draft ordinance provisions that are being presented at this time. We're asking the City Council for direction to draft provisions along the lines of these proposed revisions. As Ann mentioned, over the last year, two downtown development projects involving SRO hotels came before the City Council to request a modification or waiver of the SRO replacement requirements so that their projects could proceed. Both received a modification and or exemption from the replacement requirement, and this was by City Council action. This prompted the City Council to ask the Housing Commission to review the ordinance in light of current conditions and come back within a year, before the end of the year, to propose some revisions to the ordinance. So that was on March 16th of this year. The Housing Commission has responsibility to administer the ordinance under the terms of the ordinance. We administer this ordinance on behalf of the City Council. So we have reviewed the SRO ordinance and have made some recommendations for potential changes. We've done this in light of the purpose of the ordinance. The ordinance was drafted to ensure retention of the existing number of SRO hotel rooms, to provide assistance to tenants that would be displaced by the demolition, conversion, or rehabilitation of SRO hotels, and to benefit the public by minimizing the adverse impact on the housing supply and on displaced persons, particularly those who are very low income, elderly, or disabled due to the loss of the SRO hotel rooms. What did we do to address the ordinance? Well, the first thing we did was we contracted for and produced an update to the citywide SRO hotel inventory. This was an inventory of SRO hotels and units citywide that had been in existence for quite some time. As we were administering the ordinance, we could see that it needed updating, that the list of hotels, the number of units was outdated. So we've performed that update, and the result of the update was to eliminate from that list properties that were a number. We found that a number of them had been demolished or converted, or they were actually presently operating as a commercial hotel. So what we did was clean up that inventory, and it sort of reduced the population of units that we're talking about. The old inventory had about 300 properties citywide and about 14,000 units. When we culled through that, we actually found that actual SRO hotels that were currently operating that way were, one, exclusively downtown, and secondly, numbered just under 4,000 units on around 90 properties. So we have what we feel is an accurate inventory, plus we have additional information, parcel numbers, photographs. We did site visits. The Housing Commission also performed public outreach and held three public meetings to receive feedback and ideas on the proposed changes. And then we developed a set of 10 proposed regulation changes for consideration by the City Council. And as a result of discussions that were held during our public meetings, we added two more proposals. Once we have direction to proceed and draft these provisions with the city attorney, we intend that we'll continue the stakeholder meetings so that they can see the final product, and then we'll bring back an actual drafted ordinance for review and approval by the City Council. To give you a little short history on the ordinance and what the provisions are today, there's been an ordinance on the books since 1983. It was an emergency ordinance to slow down the loss of SRO hotels due to market forces. It became permanent in 1987 and included in that ordinance tenant relocation and a one-for-one replacement requirement for hotels that were removed from the rental market. Then in 2004, the City Council amended the ordinance to ensure compliance with California Government Code, which was a result of the Ellis Act, which allowed property owners to remove rental units from the market in order to exit the rental housing business. This was followed by an assembly bill, 1217, which actually officially granted cities the right to regulate SRO hotels apart from the rest of the rental market. So the SRO ordinance was revised in as a result of these bills. The city in the 2004 amendment allowed owners of SRO hotels to file a notice with the city that said they withdraw the accommodations from rent, and therefore they would be exempt from the replacement requirement under the ordinance. And they can do that prior to January 1 of 2004, and then they would be exempt. And so it created an exempt list of approximately 22 properties that are today not subject to the replacement requirement, although they are still subject to relocation requirements. So the ordinance terms currently still provide the one-for-one replacement, or in alternative to that, an in-lieu fee can be paid that is calculated as 50% of the actual cost of replacement. It's a formula that takes the square footage and multiplies it by a cost factor. It also estimates the land cost value, and that goes into the calculation of the in-lieu replacement fee. Or you can receive exemption under the ordinance if the SRO that's going to be converted or demolished is replaced with a very low-income housing project. Or if you're a nonprofit developer and you're developing a low-income senior housing project. The ordinance has provisions for relocation. A relocation assistance payment is provided to displaced tenants, and it's equal to 2 times their average monthly rent. That's their total payment. And if they are a long-term tenant, they receive another payment that maxes out at $210. So if, for instance, your rent was $500 a month, the average tenant, long-term tenant, would receive about $1,200 to move and acquire a new rental unit. So let me move on to the proposed revisions to the ordinance. Again, we're taking into account the burden on the tenants and the actual replacement and preservation of SRO hotels. The first proposal is to clarify the definition of SRO hotels. This potential change, what we intend to do is limit the definition to the actual inventory. Now that we have an updated inventory, we know how many properties are SRO hotels. We would draft a definition that limits it to that particular inventory. This would provide clarity to the SRO hotel owners as well as potential purchasers of which hotels are subject to the inventory and which ones are not. We would also provide an administrative process whereby if an owner who owned a hotel and it appeared on the inventory and they didn't feel that it was an SRO hotel, there'd be a process where they could come in and provide facts to establish that they're not an SRO hotel and gain a determination and then be removed from the list. The second proposal on the SRO hotel replacement fund fee, the fee is currently 50% of the cost of providing replacement SRO units. We would propose that the fee be that we develop a set fee that could be indexed. Right now, we go through a cost calculation, and the development cost and the land cost have to be updated every so often to keep that actual formula current. What we would like to do is initially set the fee at current rates and then tie it to an index so that would happen automatically. We've received feedback through the stakeholder meetings to with a request to make sure we use an index that reflects activity locally and not an maybe a national index, but to just make sure that the index reflects local real estate market activity. The next proposal is with regard to the replacement requirement. The current requirement is to replace 100% of the SROs that are being demolished or converted. We suggest that this be revised to require the replacement of 50% of the units, and it would then match the 50% of cost requirement. This would actually reduce the replacement fee requirement, and to give you an idea of how much, if you make an assumption of a 50-unit SRO hotel with 200-square-foot units, if we apply our current cost formula, the replacement fee alone, not the relocation fee, but just the replacement fee, and they have both of these fees, would be about $1.7 million. With this revision, when we run it through that same formula and have both the cost and the replacement at 50%, it lowers the fee to just under $1 million. With the next proposal is with regard to replacement location. Right now, the SRO replacement has to be within the same plan area. And because all of these SROs are downtown, replacement involves a very high land cost, which often makes, you know, the actual physical replacement infeasible. So the proposal is to allow replacement outside of downtown, near transit and services. It would allow replacement to happen at a lower cost and provide more affordable choices. The next item is the density bonus proposal. A lot of new projects that involve SROs on the block involve new construction as well as a density bonus application that is requested. And what we propose is like what we do with other multiple layers of affordable housing requirements, and that would be to allow the density bonus unit that would have a 55-year requirement. What we would do is restrict the first 30 years at the replacement level, which is a very low income, 50% AMI for 30 years. And then for the balance of the 55, it would step back up to the density bonus affordability requirement. So we would allow the overlap of these restrictions, which is typical for other affordable housing programs. The next item is was really focused on the fact that there are SRO operators downtown who are in the business. They've been in the business for a long time. They want to stay in the business. But because, and many of them have no covenants on these buildings, and they're operating them at affordable levels. And that creates challenges for when you want to make improvements to the building. This proposal would, and it's not too different from a similar program downtown for market rate, but it would allow unused site density. If you have an old and even historic building, the density for the site is potentially higher than the present use, gives them the availability to sell the unused density to another developer that could use the density in one of their new projects, and that would generate a revenue source. And what we would do is tie it back to the building and require that it be used on improvements to the SRO building. Tenant relocation. This is one of the major reasons that we're looking at the ordinance. The city council and the housing commission staff saw that tenant relocation payments were really insufficient for a very low income tenant to be able to go find a new unit. Finding a new unit was difficult to begin with, but doing it with 2 months of your very low income rent was not enough. So what we're proposing is to tie it to the HUD fair market rent, which again would be this index that the new rents are published annually. So it would go up with the HUD fair market rent. And presently the proposed 2016 rent, fair market rent for an efficiency unit is $1,028. So, and we also propose that it be a 3 month rent payment, as opposed to a 2 month rent payment. So to give you an example, once again, a 50-unit SRO with 50 residents, under the current ordinance, their relocation payment at, say, an average $500 a month rent for their residents, they would pay approximately $70,500 in relocation assistance to the 50 residents. That payment would increase to $154,200 to pay the fair market rent for 3 months to all of their long-term tenants. Option to purchase. This is a proposal for owners who have decided to sell their SRO hotel unit, create an avenue for them to offer the Housing Commission an offer to an option to purchase the SRO at an appraised fair market value subject to the SRO requirements. The intent of this provision would be to actually provide another potential market for the sale of the SROs, and these wouldn't be the ones that are maybe located near the gas lamp. They might be a little more challenging, maybe because of their present condition, maybe because of where they are located. But what it would provide us as the Housing Commission, if resources are available, an opportunity to preserve the building and the housing stock and ensure that they remain affordable. Then we have two more, and then we have two resident proposals or stakeholder proposals. The two on the screen are more administrative, updating the redevelopment language. There's some old California redevelopment language in the ordinance that we would remove. And we would also provide a cost recovery deposit provision to the ordinance. It doesn't exist there now. In practice, we're requesting $3,000 on deposit that we actually bill staff time against when we review these applications. We would like to formalize that and put it in the ordinance. The last two items were discussed at the stakeholder meetings, and they're very creative and interesting provisions that we would like to add to our proposals and take them forward to City Council. The first one is a master lease program and determine whether the City of San Diego should develop and implement a program similar to one that San Francisco has, in which the city or a nonprofit partner can master lease an SRO building. Of course, you know, if the owner seeks that, to ensure that the units remain affordable and available to low-income tenants. And that would mean that we could bring in a service provider, we could master lease units, and suddenly we have more roofs that we could graduate homeless residents prior homeless that go through programs, and we would actually have roofs to transfer these folks into permanent housing situations. And then finally, allow the purchase of existing rental units to satisfy the replacement requirement. Right now, they can build or acquire buildings to provide replacement units. This proposes that the city allow the owner of an SRO to purchase existing rental units that aren't otherwise subsidized or restricted. There was an owner of an SRO that got up in the audience and said, you know, gee, I have a building and there are a certain number of SRO units in the building, but the rest of them aren't SRO units. But I wouldn't object to having covenants on the rest of those units if there's someone out there that has a replacement requirement and would entertain the thought of purchasing those units. So this would be a provision that would design that option as a way of replacement. In closing, we have designed these proposals for amendment to the ordinance to give more certainty to owners and purchasers of SRO hotels, to increase protection for the very low-income tenants who face displacement, to provide incentives for preservation, which don't exist now, and to actually get more units built through some of the incentives, and also to receive more in-lieu fees. Right now, the in-lieu fees on these projects can actually make a development project very difficult to proceed. We saw that in the two that came before the City Council. We're proposing adjustments to the fee, which we feel that are more in line with an in-lieu fee, and that more owners of new projects would be, if they couldn't replace the units, would be inclined to pay the fee that would provide us with more funds to actually pursue replacement units. The Housing Commission will present these proposals to the City's Smart Growth and Land Use Committee on December 9th. We anticipate going to the City Council on December 15th of this year and request direction to move forward on any or all of the proposals and draft ordinance provisions to reflect the proposals. And that concludes my presentation.
Commissioner Tassel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to congratulate you for having done pretty good due diligence here. I especially like some of the provisions that would allow be able to make up that inventory in other areas. That just makes a lot of sense. I think you have a mix of private sector dynamics that are occurring with the goal of the public sector of trying to retain SRO inventory. I think it's reflected in these recommendations that you've brought forward here. I think you do have a mix of incentives as well as some protections for the low income. So I congratulate you. I think you guys have thought about this thing pretty well.
Thank you.
Couple of questions. Okay. Generally, I think I'm pretty good at reading comprehension. But there's some things in your new proposals that I'm having difficulty with. We'll start with item number 3, housing replacement requirement. The current requirement to replace 100% of the SRO units that are being demolished or converted, you're proposing to reduce to only 50%. And then you complete that sentence or that by saying this revision will result or may generate a larger number of housing units being preserved. I'm not sure how we reduce 100% to 50% and save more. Please help.
The replacement requirement goes into the calculation of the fee. It's sort of a two-part requirement under the ordinance, and it's related to the fee that is, right now, it's 50% of the cost of replacement. So you take the square footage, you multiply it by the cost fee, and you get that number, and you divide it in half. And then you multiply it by the replacement requirement, which right now is 1-to-1, and we would reduce that to 50%. So it becomes a 50% replacement requirement. And we did this because we look at the larger developments downtown and look at the replacement in-lieu fee that they're required to pay, and it's something that the new project can't sustain. And so what happens is they come to City Council and ask City Council the question.
Okay, so if I understood that statement correctly, you just said that if the City Council is undisciplined and doesn't apply the current ordinances as they're written, that we end up with a lot less fees because they've rolled over as they have on at least one of these two occasions that you've talked about.
I wouldn't say that. I think the larger issue is there are going to be developments that don't proceed with conversion because it's not financially feasible to do so. I think the ones that go to the council are probably the rare and few. I think there's more projects that just would not move forward with development or rehab, and that therefore they will continue to deteriorate. We aren't getting replacement units.
I think number two deals with dollars and number three deals with units, right?
Yes.
So I think the last sentence in number three likely relates to number two.
Yes.
Mr. Gentry, you started to say something?
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
In my native North Carolinese, if you require half as much, you might get more of a total response. It's almost like supply-side economics. It's incentives to the owners to do better with the properties. And we've tried to strike a balance between the needs of the owners as well as the needs of our customers, the residents who live there. And the current, what we've heard continually from the owners is that the current SRO regs provide no incentives for either getting out of the program or for bettering the units. So therefore many of these units have continued to deteriorate. So we think if we reduce some of the burden on the owners, we get more owners to respond with a betterment of the properties or better replacements. Is that a fair representation?
Yes, it is. And if we look at history in our administration of the ordinance over the last 6 years, maybe even 8 years, we aren't seeing the units replaced, and we have no fees in our SRO replacement fees.
So if we currently the owners are punished no matter what they do, unless the property has such a greater economic value in an alternate use that it pays itself out of the problem. So we're looking to something that incents the owners and will eventually provide a better end product rather than the current system, which does not provide incentives but only punishments.
When you're looking at the in-lieu fee replacement, it says 50% of replacement cost based on current cost of comparable SRO hotels in the city. How are we going to determine that cost? Is that an estimated cost of construction, or is that based on actual?
It's an estimated cost of construction that takes into account, you know, the SRO style of unit, which, you know, has shared facilities and that type of thing. They're typically very small units. But what we do is take the residential square footage, not the common areas and hallways and that type of thing. And then it is multiplied by an actual construction cost, a hard construction cost, and we do include indirect costs in that as well. And then there's another estimate of what the square foot land value is. And then we have to look at how many SRO units are required to be replaced and how much land would be required to replace them. And then that is also included in the formula. So, yes, it's an estimated cost. We engage a consultant to go out and look at the current market conditions. And as you know, they change frequently. So we have to keep doing that. Presently, it's been about 4 years since we've done that. So it's, you know, it's time to do it again, which is a reason that's related to one of the other recommendations, and that is to set the fee and then tie it to an index. So that it would be a, we would just come up with a replacement fee, and which would be an average, and then tie it to an index to streamline that. And then also a potential buyer or developer can kind of estimate what their costs would be. Right now, they really can't. It's too complicated.
Well, we've heard this morning that in the last two plus years, or maybe a little bit more than that, the cost of construction has gone up significantly. Why haven't we gotten around to adjusting this number?
Well, we haven't had a significant number of applications until this past year and a half.
I was in attendance at a meeting last evening that one of the topics of discussion was the proposed development at 7th and Market, which is kind of shorthandedly called the Ritz Hotel Project. Sometimes it's called the Whole Foods Market Project. And in there, the developer indicated that he's going to rehabilitate the Claremont SRO there on the southwest corner of the block. And in addition to that, he's going to have, and he said it was only 32 units. Your index indicates it's in the 50s. But then he also said he was going to anticipate having an affordability requirement of about 54 units. If I look at this density bonus and the proposal that we allow density bonus to be transferred over and utilized for SRO, it sounds as if that were in effect at the time that he goes forward, instead of having a proposed 80 plus units, we'd end up with a proposed 50 units. How is that going? If I'm interpreting that correctly, how is that going to give us more SRO units?
Well, we've heard this proposal preliminarily. That particular application has not come in the door yet. But as I understand that project, I believe what he's doing is preserving the hotel and placing the covenants on it for the replacement value. And then the density bonus, I'm unsure of how many units that might be, but those would be additional units under density bonus. He's fully providing for all of the SRO units, so I don't think the overlap in this proposal is occurring. But I understand your point that if there was a new project that had a replacement requirement and density bonus, they would max out at whichever one is larger, the number of units. Total number of units would max out at whichever requirement is larger. If they had 20 SRO units to replace and only 10 density bonus restrictions, affordability restrictions, we'd max out at 20. You're correct.
I'm just not sure that the goal of this organization, which is to provide affordable housing to, you know, wherever it's needed within the city, in much greater numbers than what we're able to do. I'm not sure that purpose is being served if we're allowing density bonus for affordable units to be used to maintain or to somehow, to maintain the existing SRO numbers.
Yeah, and that's exactly, I mean, the feedback we want to hear is, what are the feedback to these proposals. With this overlap, what currently happens, for example, with density bonus and inclusionary housing program, that's an example of how that is handled today, where the density bonus may require, 10 units at 50% AMI, or 20 units at 60% AMI, and inclusionary may require 10% at 65, or doesn't
requires an option. So a developer may use density bonus, and they'll meet both inclusionary and density bonus on the same site. But what occurs, and I think what is being proposed here, is that at the end of the day, I think what the city is receiving and the public is receiving is a lower AMI because the SRO regulations are at 50% AMI. Density bonus has both a 50 and a 60% AMI. And if you were under inclusionary and were providing units at 65% AMI. And so it's kind of marrying the various programs, getting additional public benefit either through extended affordability at an AMI or a term. So, but certainly we would love to hear your feedback if there's objection to that. We want to know that, and we can certainly take that into consideration with how this gets structured at the end of the day.
And then just a little bit on an informational basis. Your charts indicate that Hotel Metro, which is being replaced very quickly here, only has 136 SRO units in there, although we know that the room inventory is 195. What happened to those other 59?
Mr. Christensen, do you know the answer to that question?
I don't.
I would point out that it's not unusual. The Hotel Churchill, when we acquired it, had 92 units, and as I recall, the SRO attached to that property was 57. So it's not unusual that a property would have fewer than the total number of units assigned to the SRO category.
I'm just amazed that somebody would pay market rate for a room at the Hotel Metro.
Yeah, and with respect to the Hotel Metro, I sort of question whether this is a good example of why you have something on the list and you allow somebody to come in and potentially move it off. My understanding is that the certificate of occupancy for this unit was issued after January 1 of 1990, which would mean it is not an SRO ordinate or SRO for the purposes of replacement housing. It would be for the purposes of relocation and different issues, but this may be an error.
Oddly enough, it closely corresponds to the number of vouchers that we've awarded to Alpha Project as a replacement for Hotel Metro. Also, looking at your chart there, on the last page of presentation material, you've indicated the Golden West Hotel with 325 units is one of the SRO owners who submitted notices pursuant to AB 1217. Does that mean that this is one of those that a couple of decades ago said, hey, someday we're going to redevelop this and we don't want to be included in your number?
Correct. The last segment of this SRO hotel inventory are those properties that did file those letters after Assembly Bill 1217, and if they did that before January 1 of 2004, they were exempted from the replacement requirement under the ordinance.
So they're not part of your 4,000 unit number that you have?
They're still an SRO for relocation assistance purposes. No, the 4,000, if you look on the list, well, maybe your list doesn't have totals. But no, it's not in the 4,000. It's an exempt. We have approximately just a little over 1,200 units that are exempt, an additional 4,000 that are not exempt and have to do both replacement and relocation.
Okay, and then one comment. I'm very pleased with the suggestion that we allow SROs, new SROs, to be either created. Actually, I'm not sure that it says that we can create new SROs. I think it merely says all we can do is replace those that are currently on the list. Personally, I don't think it would be a bad thing to allow us to create new SROs. But I like the idea that we can relocate it to other areas of the city where there's a need for more affordable housing and cheaper land so that we can create more units. So that's something I'm very pleased with. Also, I want to thank you very much, as Mr. Tassin did, for the time and detail that's obviously gone into this. Thank you. Any comments? Any action?
I have a question.
Commissioner Spoon?
Again, let me say, I think this is an excellent presentation, and I can't even imagine the amount of work that you put into this. I mean, it's very, very well done. On number 8, the Housing Commission option to purchase, it says at an appraised fair market value. As we know, fair market value can be determined in many ways. And then it says subject to the SRO requirements, which implies that it's discounted cash flow of rent, right? I think that that would certainly discourage any owner from exercising this particular option. So my proposal would be to eliminate subject to the SRO requirements and then just see what happens. I mean, then you'll get an appraisal based on several different methodologies, and then the negotiations can start. I mean, very likely the Housing Commission will need to pay a premium for these properties, and with that in there, it wouldn't be allowed.
Correct. I don't know if Mr. Christensen would like to comment on that proposal.
You get into an interesting area of gift of public funds situation. If the current value, generally an appraisal will be done based upon the current restrictions on the property. So if you went to sell it, it would be appraised subject to whatever restrictions exist on the property. So in this case, the SRO would be subject to the replacement housing requirement. I think the idea of this was to give and it would only occur in the case that an owner came in and said, look, I just want to be done with this. And I'd like to, rather than going on the market and trying to sell it or doing this, I'd like an avenue where we can offer it to a public entity to purchase. And so it would allow the ability for the commission to do it. I'm not saying you can't do it at full fair market value, but to the extent the government is giving money in excess of what the value is, it implicates potential gift of public funds issues. On the other hand, you could argue that the benefit to the public agency and to the population is the preservation of this, and that is worth paying the extra money. I just raise it as a potential legal issue. It doesn't mean it can't be done. It's something that we need to look at.
Well, appraisals are done based on cost, discounted cash flow of rents, or highest and best use. So it would seem to me if you're going to get an appraisal, it should be based on all three, and then negotiations start.
We'll look at that proposal. Thank you.
For a fact, the YWCA doesn't have 147 units. They have 147 beds.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
And I do have a question on page 5 under fiscal considerations. What you've said is this action does not have any fiscal impact. How did you determine that? Seems like we're talking about money.
At this point, it does not. We will be bringing this back when we have looked at all of these and taken them through and gotten City Council comments as well. This is more the policy direction of the ordinance amendments. And when they direct us to, yes, we like 1, 3, 7, and 12, and then we will draft actual language and bring them back, and that's when we will if approved, we will have a fiscal impact.
Maybe it just should be listed as uncertain.
Okay.
Yeah,
yes,
I agree. Commissioners, what is your wish? Commissioner Spoon has moved approval of the motion. Commissioner Tassin has seconded the motion. Is there any additional discussion? Seeing no indication of such, I'll call the vote. All in favor of the proposal as submitted by staff, understanding that it will come back for a final review and approval at some point in the future, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? It carried unanimously. Thank you.
I thought you were
said she said start it. Okay. Item 107, North Park Seniors Apartment. Gentlemen.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, Mr. Gentry, Mr. Christensen, Ted Miara, Director of Housing Finance. With me is Joe Correa, Real Estate Project Manager. Item 107 is a preliminary bond item and loan recommendation for North Park Seniors. This project proposes funding through our rental housing NOFA, which opened in September. The Housing Commission awards funds on a competitive basis, utilize minimum threshold and priority criteria to evaluate and rank applications. Minimum threshold criteria includes developer experience and capacity, financial strength, compliance history, affordability structure and term, and maximum leveraging of non-Housing Commission funding. Under the priority criteria of the NOFA, developers have a menu of options to garner points. The current NOFA has the following priorities: project location, targeting the formerly homeless, economies of scale, the history of residual payments or committing to a minimum payment, project readiness, and Housing Commission option to purchase. The developer elected to meet all of the priority criteria and received a maximum score. The deal before you is unique, it's innovative, and the developer took some risks along the way. Community Housing Works acquired two adjacent parcels in 2013 and entitled both. In addition to receiving a 35% density bonus, they also received a site-specific ordinance that was approved by the city for an additional 14 units. The inclusionary housing requirements for both parcels were transferred to the subject site, and the other parcel was sold to a market rate developer. Real estate deals are harder and harder to come by, especially in prime locations such as North Park. This is a good example of challenges affordable housing developers face and innovative ideas and risks they have to take to make deals work. I'd like to point out that Attachment 4 is in draft form. This is the proposed loan terms. We are working closely with our general counsel and the developer to finalize. An executed version will be attached to the Housing Authority reports. The final version will have minor changes, but nothing material enough to change the deal structure or the financial position of the Housing Commission. With that, I'll let Joe give a formal presentation.
Good morning, Housing Commission members. This item, as Ted said, is the North Park Seniors Apartments Loan Recommendation and Preliminary Bond Items. Let me play Mark Zuckerberg here and turn the...
Before you go any further, will they be able to transfer any of these this density bonus over to SRO units?
Not unless you wish it so. Our recommendations are that the Housing Commission recommend to the Housing Authority first to approve the developer's request for a residual receipts loan up to $7 million to Texas Street Senior Housing LP for new construction of 76 units for seniors. The loan would be contingent on the developer receiving third-party funding commitments, including approximately $8.5 million of 4% tax credits. The second recommendation is to approve initial steps for the Housing Authority's issuance of up to $15 million of tax-exempt multifamily housing revenue bonds. That would include issuing a bond inducement resolution, authorizing an application to the California Debt Limit Allocation Committee for bonds authorization, approving a bond counsel, which would be Squire Patton Boggs, and a bond financial advisor, which would be CSG Advisors. Also requesting City Council hold a tax equity Fiscal Responsibility Act, TEFRA hearing. This is an IRS requirement when you issue bonds. Are we there? I've gone too far. Oh, I think my... I think my editors have removed one of my slides. All right. Third recommendation is to authorize the President and Chief Executive Officer to execute documents, adjust terms as necessary, perform acts necessary or appropriate to implement with the General Counsel's advice, and to substitute funds as necessary, up to $7 million of proposed total loan, which may not increase. Development summary, the developer is Community Housing Works. They are an experienced, award-winning nonprofit developer. We've worked with them before, and they've done great work on previous projects. This is new construction of 76 units for seniors. It's at 4200 Texas Street. The site is centrally located with nearby community amenities, including transportation and shopping. The site is vacant. It's infill land, currently used as a parking lot. It's being built as a four-level building above a one-level parking garage. Community Housing Works has a memo of understanding with the San Diego Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Community Center to provide services that address the needs of a senior's population with management sensitivity awareness to LGBT seniors' issues. The LGBT Center will provide LGBT-affirming management services. Community Housing Works is requesting 8 project-based Section 8 vouchers via the Housing Commission, which will be targeted to seniors who are homeless or at risk of becoming homeless. I want to touch upon prevailing wage. The project cost estimates do not currently include prevailing wage. There is an estimate that they will be applying for California state infill infrastructure grant funds, which typically do require prevailing wage. The developer proposes 2 separate contracts. One, the portion of the IIG funds that go for the parking garage to be prevailing wage, and the rest of the building, which would not be prevailing wage. We would need further analysis by our general counsel and a letter from the State Department of Industrial Relations in order to go proceed with that scenario. We have in your report a summary of both the project and Table 1 and a development team summary in Table 2. This is the location map, which shows you that it's located at the corner of Texas Street and Howard, a block south of El Cajon Boulevard. This gives you just an overall of the vicinity. This is the a site photo, which shows the corner lot, vacant parking lot. Another view from across the street, and still another view looking north. Estimated sources and uses are summarized in our tables in Table 3A and 3B at page 6. Total development costs we're looking at are estimated at $24,818,921, which is $326,565 per unit. The Housing Commission engaged a third-party consultant, R.S. Means, from the Gordian Group to review the hard construction costs. And for hard construction costs, the consultant estimated a range of $15.5 million to $17.5 million, which compares to the developer's estimated hard costs of $13,346,000, including a contingency. We have a Table 4 also, which shows you a performance indicator. We compare the project with other projects in Table 5, and as you can see in Table 5, the cost per unit is among the lowest, or it is the lowest, of the comparables that we show in Table 5. The Housing Commission subsidy per unit is $92,105. The hard costs per square foot are not the lowest, but not the highest. They're in the mid-range. Affordability, we have a table 6 at page 7, which summarizes the affordability. 75 units will be affordable with a mix of studios, one-bedroom units, and two-bedroom units, plus one restricted manager's unit. Development timeline, we're hoping to go to the Housing Authority. Should you approve the item today, we would go to the Housing Authority on December 8th. SIDLAC and TCAC applications by December 15th. There is some urgency to proceeding. HUD is changing the calculation formula for calculating how much total tax credits you can obtain. And this will be operational in 2016 under the current SIDLAC rules. This would reduce potential tax credits, but the California Debt Limit Allocation Committee has provided a dispensation that if you submit an application to them by December 15, you can go under the old rules. And the impact, put simply for this project, is if they are able to apply to CIDLAC by April 15th, it would preserve about $1,940,000 in tax credits. December 15th, what did I say? Oh, well, you're right. If they can file by December 15th, they will preserve about $1,940,000 in tax credits for the project. So there's some urgency in proceeding, and we and the developer have been going furiously trying to get everything together to meet that December 15th deadline. Let me continue. The proposed bond issuance is up to $7 million. $15 million. The developer is responsible for payment of all costs into the bond financing. The bonds do not financially obligate the city, the housing authority, or the housing commission, and neither the full faith and credit nor the taxing power of the city nor the full faith and credit of the housing authority are pledged to payment of the bonds. There is one change I wanted to make. There is a housing commission option to purchase during the 2 years at the end of the 15-year tax credit period, and I think the report currently says 3 years, but that has been changed to a 2-year period, page 7, first paragraph. On December 6th, we presented this item to the Housing Commission's Real Estate Committee, and it was approved. With us today are, I believe...
That would be November 6th.
Is it November?
This is still November.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. I've got my dates totally confused.
That's okay.
Well, this item was presented, whatever day, to the Real Estate Committee, and they approved it.
And you did a great job that day.
I must have. I've hallucinated the entire incident, I think. With us today and available for questions are from Community Housing Works, Sophie Martinez, Sue Reynolds, and Ann Wilson. So let me open it up for questions from the board.
Before you do, can we get a light? We have a speaker request form from Rebecca. Rebecca, I'm going to mess up that hyphenated name. So you're Rebecca from 3909 Center Street. Okay. Please identify yourself.
Sorry. Rebecca Hookheld. I'm the Director of Public Affairs from the San Diego LGBT Community Center. Good morning to you all. I'm here representing the center in complete support of this project. We've been working with Community Housing Works for some time, and we just think this is such a great project, and we're really looking forward to be able to continue serving seniors as we've done for 12 years now at the center. And with our unique partnership with this project, we're looking forward to be able to continue that work. Thank you so much.
Before you leave, in the request here, it wasn't mentioned, but it kind of was mentioned, but wasn't mentioned. We're going to have property management services provided by Con Am Property Management. And then tenant services are going to be provided by your organization. What's included in the tenant services?
I'm sure that, among other things, we're going to be client-based services. Along that will be included health-based services, connecting our seniors with other referrals if needed. There are going to be recreational services, community-oriented within the community itself. Many of the services that we continue to provide at the center now will be focused on the tenants in this project.
Commissioner Moraga?
Thank you for the presentation. This is an exciting project. But one quick question. Prevailing wages, should those be triggered? Who's going to cover that delta?
That would be the developer's responsibility. Our loan may not exceed the $7 million referenced in the report.
Additional questions? Do the principals of Community Housing Works wish to get up and say anything in addition? We always enjoy hearing from you.
Does that work? I would like to just really thank the commission staff. This has been going through a very expedited process to help us get to this December 15th deadline in order to preserve about $1.7 million, $1.9 million. I don't have the exact number of tax credits if this change is made for 2016. And I know it's taken a lot of late nights because it's complicated to get these things done. We're just proud to have worked on this development. We think it's going to be an incredible addition to the North Park community. North Park Planning Association approved it with unanimous. One person did not want the one across the street, the market rate, to be rental. They wanted the condo. They wanted to make sure it was rental, but everything else was unanimous approval. The center is going to provide services for all the residents, and it is going to be marketed and fit with fair housing. But it is going to make it very clear that if you want to live there, it's going to have an LGBT-affirming environment so that it can be a safe place for the seniors. The current generation of senior lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered people were really the pioneers. And many of them back in the days, like the 50s, you know, they were rejected by their families. They lost families. They weren't able to have they don't have those kinds of supports. And in their senior years, a study that the center did really identified a need to have more supports around the housing for this generation. So we're looking forward to being able to help provide housing that's affordable and supportive.
Will ConAm have bodies on, boots on the ground in the current vernacular this week in terms of the daily property management?
Oh, there's always a resident manager and a person on the property, you know, on any property this size every day of the week.
Okay. All I can tell you is that, you know, we've obviously been involved with you guys for quite some time, and you've done multiple projects with us, and they're always very attractive. And I know that everybody that we do partnerships with look for LEED Platinum or LEED Gold or anything else. But if you can find a couple of opportunities to save a buck or two as you're going forward, it'd be wonderful.
You know, when we do green elements and energy saving and water saving elements, the majority of those lead to lower operating expenses. So, you know, the extra insulation that they require means you use less energy in the apartment units and in the community rooms. Lower water, everything that we do in general, we really drive to things that are going to make the property less expensive to operate over time and therefore a healthier, more sustainable property. So I agree with you on that.
Commissioners, any additional comments, questions? Commissioner Moraga has moved approval. Commissioner Davis has moved to second that motion. Again, I'll ask for discussion. Seeing no indication of such, is there a vote? I'll call the vote. All in favor of the motion, say aye. Opposed? Let's move forward. Okay. Let the record reflect that currently Commissioner Tassin is still present but had to step out of the room on a work-related matter, that Commissioners Moraga and Spoon have had to leave, and that was based upon the prior information that we had about that, but also that the record reflect that we still have, with those members present in the room, a quorum, and we will proceed with the agenda as it is. So now, if I can remember all the revisions that I've made here, we're going to item 110. 110? Yes. See, it just changed everything, didn't it? You were ready for 108, and we moved it. So.
Good morning again, Commissioners. Ted Miara. With me is Cameron Shariati, Assistant Real Estate Manager. Item 110 is a preliminary bond item for Vista Vista La Rosa. There are five bond items on today's agenda. I would like to just reiterate what Joe had said in his previous presentation about bond issuances. As bond issuer, there is no direct liability to the Housing Commission, Housing Authority, or City. There is no pledge of the City or Housing Authority's faith, credit, or taxing power. Issuance of bonds does not constitute a general obligation to the issuer. Repayment of bonds is limited to private revenue sources, such as project revenues. And the Commission engages bond counsel and a financial advisor on all transactions to assist in the bond issuances. The financing structure of the proposed project does not include any gap financing from the Housing Commission. And I'll turn it over to Cameron for a presentation.
Yeah, I feel as if you just gave all the disclaimers for a medical, a new drug on that's advertised on TV. Please.
Good morning, Commissioners. Item 110 is a request for a recommendation that the Housing Authority issue a bond inducement resolution for up to $57 million in multifamily housing revenue bonds for the acquisition and rehabilitation of Vista La Rosa, authorize application submittals to the California Debt Limit Allocation Committee. For a bond allocation, approve the selected financing team, and that the Housing Authority authorize the President and CEO of the Housing Commission to execute and perform acts as appropriate to implement upon advice of General Counsel and or Bond Counsel. In addition, staff requests that City Council hold a Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act public hearing and adopt a resolution approving the issuance of multifamily housing revenue bonds. The proposed project is an existing 242-unit multifamily development located in the Otay Mesa Nestor Community Plan Area at 2002 Rimby Avenue. The neighborhood is comprised of predominantly single-family, multifamily, and commercial uses with several parks, schools, and a neighborhood shopping facility located in close proximity. The property was originally constructed in 1970 and consists of 200 two-bedroom units and 42 three-bedroom units contained within 19 two-story walk-up wood frame and stucco buildings. Current amenities include a leasing office, a laundry room, a gated pool and patio area, as well as a community room with a kitchen and computer lab. The property was last rehabilitated in 2000 and is showing signs of aging and as such is in need of rehabilitation in order to maintain marketability and extend its useful life. The proposed scope of rehabilitation includes comprehensive renovations to the unit interiors, renovation of the lobby and common areas, as well as upgraded landscaping. The developer of the project is Standard Property Company. During the 15-year tax credit compliance period, the project will be owned by a to-be-formed limited partnership comprised of an affiliate of Standard acting as administrative general partner, Housing on Merit acting as the nonprofit managing general partner, and a to-be-selected investor limited partner. Standard is a for-profit multifamily investment and management corporation headquartered in Los Angeles. Since 2010, Standard has completed 13 tax credit transactions consisting of nearly 3,000 affordable units across the country. Housing on Merit is a nonprofit organization formed in 2011 that develops and manages affordable and transitional housing facilities. HOM provides comprehensive support services, including job training, as well as life skills and wellness education to more than 3,000 residents. The total development cost of the project will be approximately $68.8 million. Sources of funding include bond proceeds, tax credit equity, and a deferred developer fee. The developer is requesting the issuance of bonds in the amount of $57 million, and there are no Housing Commission funds being proposed for this project. 90% of the units in the development will be targeted to households at or below 60% of AMI, while the remaining 10% will be targeted to households at or below 50% of area median income. Rents for two-bedroom units will range from $911 to $1,093, while three-bedroom units will range from $1,013 to $1,215. The requested actions are preliminary steps to issue bonds, and the project will be brought forward for final approval in April of 2016. The developer expects to close financing and begin rehab work shortly thereafter and complete the project by the end of the year. This concludes our presentation, and we're available for any questions.
Commissioners, any questions at this point? Is the proposed developer here?
They are not here today.
Shucks. Okay. Like to see who we're dealing with. Okay, so no questions, no discussions. Is there a motion? Okay, Commissioner Hubbard has made the motion. I'm sorry, Dottie, but Commissioner Davis actually said she seconded it first. So we moved and seconded. Is there, again, any discussion? No. In that case, we'll call the vote. All in favor of the proposal as submitted, indicate by saying aye. Opposed? Done. Thank you. Now, well, we've got number 112, don't we? 111. I'm just moving ahead. You guys look familiar.
Morning again. Item 111 is a preliminary bond item for the development of homeless veteran housing and permanent supportive housing. The developer of the project is Chelsea Investment Corporation. They are currently in the process of negotiating a partnership with St. Vincent de Paul. Chelsea will be applying for veteran housing and homeless prevention funding from the state in December. In addition, they are evaluating both affordable housing and sustainable communities program funding from the state, typically referred to as cap and trade, and also evaluating the Housing Commission's Housing First San Diego NOFA. Staff thinks this is a great project. The population will include homeless vets, a population that lacks housing options, and the development will be located two blocks from a rapid transit bus station. With that, I'll turn it over to Cameron.
As Ted mentioned, this is another request for a recommendation that the Housing Authority take preliminary actions to issue bonds, including issuance of a bond inducement resolution for up to $19 million in multifamily housing revenue bonds for the development of the lofts at Normal Heights, authorize application submittals to SIDLAC for a bond allocation, approve the selected financing team, and authorize the president and CEO of the Housing Commission to execute and perform acts as appropriate to implement upon advice of council, and that the City Council hold a tax equity and fiscal responsibility act public hearing and adopt a resolution approving the issuance of housing revenue bonds. The project is a 50-unit multifamily development to be located in the Normal Heights Community Plan area at the intersection of El Cajon Boulevard and 38th Street. The site is currently vacant, and surrounding uses are comprised of predominantly single-family and multifamily dwellings with commercial-oriented facilities situated along El Cajon Boulevard. The unit mix will be comprised of 11 studio units, 21 one-bedroom units, and 10 two-bedroom units contained within three-story wood frame construction over subterranean parking. Proposed project amenities will include a leasing office, laundry room, tenant service space, and a community room. Chelsea Investment Corporation will be the developer of the project in a 2B form limited partnership. The project will be targeted to homeless veterans and individuals requiring supportive services, case management, and other wraparound services, which will be provided by a residential homeless provider. The 2015 homeless point in time count estimates that there are just over 5,500 homeless individuals in the city of San Diego. Projects utilizing the Housing First methodology to provide supportive services and help stabilize tenants are key in the fight to end homelessness in San Diego. As Ted had mentioned, the target population includes homeless veterans, and as such, Chelsea intends to apply for the state's Veterans Housing and Homelessness Prevention Program, which has approximately $75 million available in the current funding application round. Additionally, the project is located within the I-15 transit corridor, less than half a mile from the Boulevard Transit Plaza, qualifying it as a high-quality transit site, which will allow Chelsea to apply under the state's Affordable Housing and Sustainable Communities Program in early 2016. Chelsea also intends to apply to the Housing Commission for VASH vouchers to further help subsidize the units and provide services for veteran households. The total development cost of the project will be approximately $19.9 million, and the developer is requesting the issuance of up to $19 million in bonds. Other sources of funding include tax credit equity and deferred developer fees. There is no Housing Commission gap funding currently being contemplated. However, the developer may apply for Housing Commission financing prior to final bond authorization. Approval of a bond inducement and TEFRA resolutions does not commit the Housing Authority to issue bonds, and the bonds would not constitute a debt of the city. If bonds are ultimately issued for the project, the bonds will not financially obligate the city, the Housing Authority, or the Housing Commission, because security for the repayment of the bonds will be limited to specific private revenue sources of the project. The requested actions are preliminary steps to issue bonds, and the project will be brought forward for final approval in November of 2016. Close of financing is expected to occur in December of 2016, with construction beginning shortly thereafter. The estimated completion date for the project is July of 2018. This concludes our presentation. We also have John Sugden and Chris Earle here on behalf of Chelsea to answer any questions. Thank you. January of 2018.
I'm not sure I understand. What's the role of Father Joe's in this development?
They will likely be the managing general partner. So they'll have an ownership role, as well as providing services to the population.
And a particular interest, I'm sure, to the future residents is probably less than three blocks away is a pretty good gun shop.
I was not aware of that.
I'm a Second Amendment proponent, so what the heck. Anyhow, any questions, any discussions? Okay. I think what we, if we can do things to get, veterans off the streets, part of the housing first, we get them off the streets, and then we can hopefully get them, the additional services they need to make them productive again as they once knew how to be. I think that's fantastic. So, is there a motion? Commissioner Davis has made the motion to approve the proposal, and Commissioner Cerdy has seconded that. Seeing no indication of discussion, I'll call the question. All in favor say aye. Opposed? Motion's carried unanimously. You guys going to stay here for the next one, too? Item 114 is a workshop and discussion regarding the Commission's housing footprint, community role, and economic impact on San Diego.
And Mr. Chairman, I'd like to open this one up, and I'll ask Lynn, please come on up. Earlier this year, I asked Lynn Reeser, who is at the Fermanian Business and Economic Institute of Port Loma Nazarene University, to conduct a study on the Housing Commission's economic impact on the community of San Diego. And it occurred to me that although most people understand the work we do in terms of charity, the work we do that helps a lot of people who need help, people tend to underestimate, if they notice at all, our economic impact on the larger community. And we have a substantial presence here economically as well as in terms of the good work that we do. And what I've asked Lynn to do is to go through, is to conduct a study that would estimate our overall economic impact on the city in the last fiscal year. And I also expect to have another study done this coming year, which will look at the overall impact of this organization for the some 36 to 37 years we've been in existence, and it will be significant. But the presentation this morning is as to last year and to a study that is about 98% done, will be issued a report, I believe, next month. But I'm going to ask Lynn, if she would, Lynn Reeser, to take the program over, introduce yourselves, if you would, please, and then please talk about the good work that you've done for us. Thank you, Lynn.
There you go. Okay. Good morning, and thank you for having us. My name is Kathy Gallagher. I'm the executive director of the Fermanian Business and Economic Institute at Point Loma Nazarene University. If you're unfamiliar with us, we are basically a consulting unit within the School of Business at Point Loma Nazarene. We offer consulting services, a variety of services to the local community as well as nationally and internationally, and for-profit, non-profit, government entities, and so forth. In addition to being the economic forecasting unit for the California State Treasurer, John Chung, we also have clients that include San Diego Zoo Global, San Diego Military Advisory Council, Semper Generation, National Association for Business Economics, and others, again, both in San Diego and nationally. Now I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Dr. Lynn Reeser, our chief economist.
Thank you, Kathy, and thank you very much, Mr. Gentry. It was a real pleasure to be able to work on this very important program. We've never done a study of a government entity before. In fact, I'm not sure if an economic impact study has ever actually been done of one. So this was new territory for us. And what I thought I'd share with you this morning, just some highlights from our study, general approach, some of the things from the key programs you have that impressed us in terms of their impact on the economy, the overall footprint, the economic numbers, and then some of the takeaways. So in terms of the basic purpose, it was to, in fact, quantify the economic impact through all the various channels of the SDHC through which you operate to determine the impact on jobs, income, gross regional product. To accomplish this, our whole team worked on the project. We interviewed all of the key members extensively of the management team of SDHC. We then collected data through a lot of work helped by the SDHE people, of all the people that benefit from the various programs, from the homeless to the people receiving the vouchers. Then all the data was collected on all the various expenditures, loans, grants, compensation, et cetera, all the contracts that are let. And then we went through an extensive analysis of all the ripple effects of the program. And we've used the model, the implant model, which is widely used in the industry to understand the dynamics. You've probably heard of the multiplier effects to really get a handle on the total impact of the San Diego Housing Commission. So in terms of some of the key elements that impressed us of the four major areas of the SDHC functions, with respect to rental assistance, the overarching impression we had was that, indeed, the SDHC is a very different model. It basically takes the dynamics, the entrepreneurship, the innovative culture of the private sector and infuses it in the government sector. And so what you really have is this hybrid model where you take the best elements of both the private and the public sector, and you see it right here in the SDHC, and this is really a model that I have not seen anywhere else. So it was very interesting to really analyze from an economist's point of view. And in terms of the specifics that we saw coming out of these four different areas that you all reached, the landlord porthole, the technology that you brought in to that area to allow the landlords and the voucher program to see their programs at work, the moving to work program, which is really bringing some groundbreaking innovation into affordable housing. And then I think the overall approach of the SDHC is very different from most government entities in that you're not looking at the people receiving the benefits as being dependent on these benefits essentially for the rest of their lives, but that the end goal is actually to make these people independent. And so from that point of view, it's interesting to note that, as you probably know, or may not know, it was really quite interesting, is that more than half of the recipients of the vouchers are receiving those vouchers for 7 years or less. So it's not a permanent factor. And although the vouchers are used highly by disabled and elderly individuals, you have the fact that 67%, about two-thirds, 65%, are actually gainfully employed and earning wages. With respect to the affordable housing program, this has increased in scope significantly so that currently there are 2,300 units that are owned or managed by the SDHC, plus another 1,000 units that are through the Housing Development Partners, so that what we have happening is a lot of innovation with the acquiring the in renovating the financing and talking to the real estate people. And I've been in banking finance most of my life, most recently with Bank of America, in a lot of work with the real estate division, and that you were able to do deals that we could not have done in the private sector. And so that's really an interesting approach and advantage that we've seen. The loans that are being made to first-time buyers, letting actually people get a rung in the housing market in this area. And you might have seen recently the study indicated that it's this is one of the hardest places to gain wealth because it's hard to get on that first rung of home ownership. So we're seeing the loan program helping that out. And here you can in fact see the loan portfolio, which you've probably seen many times, but in terms of the economics going into it and coming out of it, just look, for instance, at the $200 million of loans outstanding for the multifamily. These loans have enabled essentially 116 properties to be developed, and that is producing rent savings in the amount of about $49 million for people who are now living in those units. So that's, I think, tangible evidence of a multiplier that's at work. The homeless program, the third major program that's active here, is one that's become very near to our hearts because Kathy and I have been, and our whole team have been working on the homeless problem for the last three or so years. Very early, St. Vincent de Paul came to us and asked for some help in terms of analyzing the impact of Project 25, where you basically took the frequent flyers, the people that were using, that's what they call them, the people that were using the emergency rooms, the jails, ambulances the most heavily. And some of these people were, if you can believe it, in the emergency rooms more than once per day during the year. And so we analyzed what would happen after 2 years of basically giving these people housing first, as opposed to the current and generally used model that these are usually the last people to qualify for housing. You try to get them all the services first, and then hopefully they get rehabilitated to the extent that you can finally get them a house. And this housing first model, as you know, turns that on its head and says, no, you put these people in secure housing, then bring them all the services. And I know when Rick and I first met for lunch, you know, I told him I was so excited we just worked on this project, and he said, well, we actually gave all those houses, homes for those Project 25 individuals. Anyway, the results of the study we found, and you may have seen this, is that after 2 years of the program, the cost of these services, net of all the expensive individualized health care and counseling that was being brought to these people as they're in these new homes, the cost of public services, net of all those expenses, fell between 60 and 80% in terms of the use of ambulances, ER rooms. I mean, and that is huge public savings. We are now conducting the second, another study for the program looking at the vulnerability index, the people who are deemed most likely to die if they're left on the streets and homes, and seeing what the housing first approach does. And we're really very excited about finding those, reporting those results. So I was, you know, really, you know, happy to see and excited to see that, you know, the 3-year strategic plan to put another, you know, 1,500 people in these programs. And finally, the whole efforts that are going through the Achievement Academy and the Family Self-Sufficiency Program, what strikes us here is this holistic approach, the view that this is not just a housing issue. And we ran into this approach, again, about 2 years or 3 years ago when we did the first study ever of the San Diego Food Bank. Who are the people that use the food bank and what are the solutions? And again, we found it was not just a food problem. This is a problem that needs to be tackled on a number of different fronts, education, counseling, family assistance. It's not just a food problem. And so what we were encouraged to see at the SCHC is that this is viewed as not just a housing problem, a sort of a tunnel vision, but you have to attack it through all these different programs, job counseling, family counseling, financial budgeting. All of these elements have to all be working together as opposed to just giving them a place to live. So turning now to some of the numbers. We thought it would be really interesting to find out what is the footprint. Who are the people that are actually touched in these various programs by the various programs? And we label this chart how many people are empowered, because as I thought about it, you know, this is really empowering people. It's not just touching people or reaching people. It's empowering them in many sense of the word. So in terms of the voucher program, about 39,000 individuals are impacted through the loan program, either directly in terms of home loans or through the units that are available through those that are financed to help people achieve reduced rental savings. The people that are affected through affordable housing programs, and then the people affected through the homeless program. So if you add that all up, and some of these people are affected more than once by different programs, but on net, this, if they're affected at least once, you're talking about 77,000 San Diegans are affected by the various programs that are coming out of this overall office. So now getting down to the economic impact, we basically divided all the spending channels into 8 groups. So just quickly going through those, the biggest one is the housing vouchers, which is about $147 million. And this affects, when we model this, this is affecting people's income. So it's basically raising their effective buying power so they have more to spend on other things produced in San Diego. The same can be said through the rent savings, again, about $49 billion through savings that can, again, be deployed in other ways in the economy. Loans affects both incomes in terms of giving people some assistance in buying their homes and also directly for builders who are using the proceeds to renovate, remodel many units. Grants, again, are many for renovation to bring those units for affordable housing. The property expense involved everything from painters to people providing plumbing services, security services, et cetera. The compensation, the 278 employees of the SDHC and their compensation. And then finally, the operations, everything from legal to accounting services to property management, and finally, capital spending. You'll notice capital spending was a fairly small item in 2014, the fiscal year. That obviously is lumpy from year to year. A lot of the projects did not really gear up until the following fiscal year. But if you roll it all up, it's about $278 million in terms of the total direct spending going into the economy. So then we look at one element of this, and that was a question, you know, how much of this stays in San Diego? And you saw the vouchers is the big line, that $149 million. And, you know, do we have a lot of absentee landlords? And the answer is no. Most of them, in fact, about two-thirds of them, live in the city of San Diego, so the money is right here. Another quarter of them are in the county, so the money is coming in from the outside. And when I talk about that total direct spending, that $278 million, most of it is outside money coming in. So that reflects an injection of funds that's directly supporting our economy. So here you can see the modeling of this. And the way it goes, you start out with the direct spending, and then there's some supply chains to the extent that you hire a contractor to work on a building, then he's got to hire subcontractors and buy all the supplies. And then there's a third element, and that's the consumer spending. And you can see that's a big piece of the total economic impact because all of these income increases, the increases in the buying power of all these households is affecting the economy significantly. So the bottom line here, the big numbers, if you look, the first column is for the city of San Diego. That's where most of the impact is, $279 million of direct spending. But then if you look at all the multiplier effects, we're looking at a creation of over 3,000 jobs, in addition to gross regional product of about $240 million, and then in addition to income of about $300 and some million. So these are very significant numbers, slightly larger numbers for the county as a whole, as some of the spending is done outside the city. So in conclusion, what again really struck us is this is a very new model. It's a very innovative model. It's a very interesting model, and I think it could represent a model that we could see emulated for many other government entities, where basically you infuse some of the good elements, the innovative, the entrepreneurial culture of the private sector into a government enterprise. The challenges, and I've heard some of them this morning, and you've seen them constantly. We are in a state, we're not creating enough new housing, so we're seeing rising homes prices and rents. Federal funding, even though we have a two-year respite from sequestration, the non-discretionary spending, as you know, is still being limited. It is under a 10-year cap program. Regulations affect affordable housing just as it affects market housing. And then also, as we heard earlier this morning, we are looking at some shortages and rising cost of the construction skills, everything from the plumbers to the painters to the carpenters. And we'll likely see our first interest rate increase next month. Still, there are some, I think, very promising directions. We're seeing here, from our point of view, looking at this as economists and business analysts, the ability to really maximize the amount of affordable housing for a given amount of funds. And I would say that for a given budget, you here are probably creating much more affordable housing than any other entity that's under HUD's jurisdiction. The Housing First strategy, we believe, from what we've seen in our preliminary work, is very promising, and I think that's going to break new ground in establishing a new model for the homeless solution in this century. The holistic approach that you see here, I think, is the way to go, to not view food problems, shortages, or housing shortages in a tunnel vision, but really to take a holistic approach. And finally, the ultimate goal, I think, here is the right one. It is not one that's looking at these people as being dependent forever on government services and making those services as good as they can be. That's important. But what's even more important is to eventually make these people independent, self-sufficient, so that I'm an economist. I spend most of my time, you know, looking at the hard numbers, but I am even more aware of the intangible effect, the value that these people feel in by being more self-sufficient, the value that they feel in terms of raising their estimate of their own self-worth, and that's really what it's all about. So thank you, and I'd now be more than happy to answer any questions.
Commissioner Davis?
Yeah, this is such an inspirational and informative report. Thank you very much. And Rick, thank you for asking for this because it makes me so proud to be a part of this organization and puts in very clear graphs and information so that I can understand it. So thank you very much.
We do try. My first job, they said, if you don't sound like an economist, you'll be okay.
That's good. Thank you.
Any other? Rick, do you have something?
Maggie, I appreciate that, but this report's your fault. It's the comes from this board. If you remember, when we went through my performance review in September and October and the goals that were laid out for me, meaning this organization for this coming year, the second of nine of those goals was to reformulate the way we market this agency to the community and to tell our story in a different way than we've done in the past, hopefully more effective. Well, it occurred to me that did not mean just keep doing more of the same. And it occurred to me that part of what that meant was communicating to a different audience that may not pay as much attention ordinarily. And part of that meant getting the a third party to take a look at us, a respected third party, who themselves would be heard when maybe we wouldn't be, hence the Fermanian folks here. And I'll point out that Kathy and Lynn have a stature in this community second to none in this regard. And so I'm going to use this report shamelessly in the next year to talk about what we do. And I'm going to ask these good folks to help me as well. In fact, Lynn, I don't think I've told you, but San Diego's Economic Development Organization, Mark Cafferty, has already asked you and me, he's asked me that we do a presentation to his board at their January board meeting. And so I intend to try to set up as many of those as possible going forward. And if you think this report looks good, wait till we put together one that shows the impact since 1979 when we were created. This one reflects an income statement for the year, if you would. And the next one is going to reflect in more of a balance sheet of what we produce, what's out there, and the long-term effect on this community. It's going to be pretty significant. And it answers questions that people don't think to ask. For instance, any number of times since I've been here, I'll point out to people that we funnel almost $150 million a year in the voucher program alone into the private real estate economy. And people will say, you do? We didn't know that. Or I'll say, you know, we produced through issuing bonds and gap financing and other measures and stuff we own, we've produced 10,000 units in this community over the last 30 years. And the answer is, you have. Because the only natural notice we tend to get is negative when something doesn't work right. When things work right, we don't get noticed. And so this is an effort to educate the public on what we do. And I think that the more the public knows about us, knows what we do and our success rate, the more opportunities we're going to have going forward. This will be instrumental in that effect. And so I wanted to present this to you all as a preview this morning, and there'll be a report forthcoming shortly. And then there'll be another chapter of this next year that we're going to present as well.
And I'm just going to pipe in just a little tiny bit. Thank you very, very much for putting this in a format that anyone, I believe, can understand. In the last few years, I commented on it earlier about our financial department, our financial statements, our financial capability. But in the last few years, we have tried to make a point of breaking the bonds of the past and looking forward, and we've intentionally formulated the idea that we may be a nonprofit organization, but that we need to operate from the standpoint that you know, the greatest good is accomplished off. Nonprofit is a tax status. It's not a business plan. And you just kind of called attention to the fact that we've been on the right track. Thank you. That brings to a close the public portion of our agenda, and we are going to go into a closed executive session. I thank you all for being in attendance and for hanging in there, those of you who hung in there for the whole thing.